This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. For the second time already this century, our president-elect won the electoral vote without getting the most votes. Before the 2000 election, that had happened only 3 times, all in the 1800s. As of this writing, Hillary Clinton received hundreds of thousands more votes than Donald Trump overall, a fact which has prompted a familiar debate.
We got to get rid of the Electoral College. That would be a good thing to do in a constitutional convention. This is an absurdity held over from slavery.
A renewed push for it to change, especially among Democrats, because they've been burned by the Electoral College twice in the past 16 years.
More than two-thirds of Americans favor a popular vote over an electoral one, but the Electoral College system, in which a group of people cast votes for president on behalf of the people in their states, is enshrined in the Constitution, so abolishing it would be tough. There is, however, a way around it. States could choose to award their electoral votes to the candidates who got the most votes nationally, effectively making the Electoral College vote and popular vote one and the same. This is an effort called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. And we'll get to that in a little bit. But first, why does the Electoral College even exist?
Well, mainly because the framers of the Constitution couldn't agree on how the nation should choose the president. Should Congress make the pick, or should the population have a say? So they punted the responsibility down to the states, granting them a number of electoral votes and the freedom to decide how to cast them. For several years, states took different approaches, but eventually most settled on the one we know well, that the winning candidate in the state takes all the electoral votes. Rob Ritchie is the executive director of the nonpartisan organization Fair Vote and co-author of Every Vote Equal. He's an advocate for electoral reform, and he says that the idea that the Electoral College prevents smaller states from being dominated by bigger ones is all wrong.
Yeah, that's an argument tied to the math that the number of electors per capita is bigger if you're in a small state than in a big state. But the reality of what really gives your state power in the Electoral College really isn't that per capita number. It's whether your state is one that the candidates compete in and actively seek your votes. And that's actually not tied to that small state math.
That is interesting. In other words, the Electoral College has a huge impact insofar as it creates swing states.
Absolutely. And in fact, there's about 35 states which now for 4 consecutive elections have been completely outside of campaign attention, that really are just spectators to the presidential election. So we don't have a United States election for president. We have a swing state election for president from the perspective of the campaigns.
Right. Let me bring up the second defense of the Electoral College, and that is essentially the electors are there to protect us from ourselves.
Right. It's a funny argument in that it was used early on in the first few years, and then within 10 years of setting up the system, we had already gotten to this partisan reality where the electors were really expected to be rubber stamps for the people who wanted them to vote a certain way, right? So the idea of them as a deliberative body that would look at this winnowed field of candidates, choose someone, we just never did that. These days, if someone did that, they're called a faithless elector because they're being faithless to what they're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, Hillary Clinton has won the popular vote, and so we're seeing petitions to abolish the Electoral College. But as you say, it's baked into the Constitution, so that's not going to happen, right?
Well, we always could change the Constitution, and I'm not going to say that we can't. We have to have 3/4 of all states pass it, and that's a challenge.
So instead of trying to change the Constitution, you back the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. What is it?
So here's the most simple aspect of it. We want to have the White House go to the candidate who wins the most popular votes in all 50 states and D.C. So that's the goal, and that's what happens once this is in place. Now, here's what happens to make sure it gets into place. States keep their electoral votes, and they change the rule for governing how they award those electoral votes. So right now, most states give all their electoral votes to whoever wins the popular vote in their state. The new rule is they're going to give all their electoral votes to the winner of the national popular vote in all 50 states and D.C. That's one change. The second part of it is They don't want to do it on their own because that conceivably could have partisan consequences. They want to make sure that they're doing it in a way that guarantees that the national popular vote winner is always going to win. So the Interstate Compact is an agreement to wait to enact it until the number of states that have passed it can make it decisive.
So basically, you need enough states to bring the total number of electoral votes to 270.
Exactly. Once it hits 270 in the next election, it becomes activated. So it's already passed in a number of states, but because it's not up to that 270 point, the current rules still govern what those states do. But once we hit 270, then we'll have a national popular vote guaranteed.
And it's been passed, I guess, in 10 states in D.C. How many electoral votes do you have so far?
That's 165 electoral votes in the participating states, so it's 105 electoral votes away.
Uh-huh.
And it's been introduced in all 50 states. It's passed state legislative chambers. And I think these kinds of debates that we're having right now about the system and how it's working for us are the kinds of ones that ultimately are going to get us across the finish line, because we want elections to be decisive, and the current system can create this argument that it's not fair. And, you know, I think we want to have a system that people believe is fair.
Aren't you essentially turning the Electoral College, without removing it, into a vestigial organ?
Well, in a certain sense, that happened 10 years into its existence. As soon as it no longer was a deliberative assembly that really picked people based on, you know, the elector's own judgment, it just became a rubber stamp. It really wasn't what the founders intended at that point, right? And people have wanted to have a popular vote for president for decades, and this is a way to get it to them.
Now, you've said this has strong bipartisan support, but aren't the vast majority of the states, if not all of them, blue?
In the wake of the 2000 election, there was a perception for many years that somehow this was a plan that would help Democrats because Gore won the popular vote and Bush won the electoral vote. The rational fact that you could look at the 2004 election and say, oh, that's interesting, Bush won it, but if it had been a little closer, he would have still won the popular vote but lost the electoral vote. You can actually show the numbers sort of reveal that.
But that's not what happened.
It wasn't as visceral, right?
And this year, it's Hillary Clinton who's won the popular vote and lost the electoral college, which suggests that maybe the situation as it stands benefits Republicans.
If there had been a popular vote for president, they would have just run a very different campaign. The fact that they zeroed in on four states and both campaigns spent half of their campaign energy in those four states and Trump won them all is a suggestion that at least he would have had a real equal chance, I think, to win a popular vote if he'd been running for it. But you're right that there's that perception. But I wanted to say this about the nature of the bipartisan support. There has been more and more Republican support, say when it passed New York State. The state Senate is run by Republicans. It passed the Arizona House this year with a Republican-run chamber, and it passed committees in Republican-run states like in Georgia and Missouri. So I'm hoping that this election actually doesn't divert attention from the core argument, which is that there's all these states that get left out, whether they're red or they're blue. Our hope is that the sort of partisan energy that's being created by what's happening right now doesn't actually interfere with the trajectory that I was seeing, which is that this national popular vote plan was heading toward likely implementation by 2020.
Tell me what the National Popular Vote Compact would have on the way we cover elections.
One of the things I like about elections is it's a chance for us as a people to get outside of some of the sort of the niche conversations we have and have more of a collective conversation. And I think when they are devoting so much of, you know, more than 90% of their actual time, but also the polling that governs what they stress is also pitched toward those 9, 10, 11 states, we're missing out on some of the really exciting things that are good about America that just happen to be associated with states that aren't swing states. You know, I think that there really would be sort of a different mix of stories. We would be hearing a little less about what the Ohio needs and interests are, and more about what all these other states' needs are as well.
I'm thinking of the iconic red-blue map. I think what you'd get is sort of violets and purples instead.
Exactly. The reddest areas still have some Democrats, and the bluest areas still have some Republicans. And that's also one thing I think which would be great is just an opportunity for those people, wherever they are, to feel connected to the choice of their leader.
Would you consider heading a movement for a national simultaneous primary day?
I am really intrigued by that proposal, but with one huge caveat, which is that we do it after we actually have all the state-by-state contests. Actively, you know, doing caucuses and primaries in every state would winnowing the field. But rather than having those contests decide at all, you would actually then have everyone on an equal basis. You know, maybe you learn something new about a candidate and you regret the vote you cast earlier.
So leave the primary system in place, but then put another vote on top of it so you get a chance to change your mind.
That's what I would do. Come together on a common day, first Tuesday in June or something, and pick the nominee.
Okay, Rob Ritchie, what the heck are you going to do about gerrymandering?
Well, there's an answer to that one, too. It's to think outside the box. And if you think of the box, in this case, it's the fact of districting itself. Because as soon as you draw the district, it's going to help some people and hurt other people because it's winner-take-all. Erase some of those district lines. So let's go from, let's say, Massachusetts, which has 9 single-member districts, meaning one person represents each district across Massachusetts, and Democrats have won every single seat for more than 2 decades. You would then say, let's have 3 districts, each with 3. So that would be step one. You'd have fewer districts with more people. And then there's methods of voting, like the ranked choice voting system they just passed in Maine, which you
get to put your first choice and your second choice and your third choice and even your fourth choice.
Yeah, you get the freedom to do that. And when you do that, the way it works is that almost everyone in that district would help elect someone. And so the district lines would be less important than how you vote. And you wouldn't have monopoly representation. You would have a degree of proportional representation, and you would have this fairer balance of viewpoints represented across the country. And right now, you have all these sort of dead-end districts. 90% of districts, you can foretell the outcome 2 years before the election, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you do this, you'd actually have a competitive reason to vote in every election. The candidates would have real incentives to engage with voters across these districts, and we'd get a nicer mix of people. We'd have urban Republicans from Manhattan, and we'd have, you know, Oklahoma Democrats, which I think Congress really needs so the parties just don't vote rubber stamp for their side.
I really appreciate your optimism. It makes me dream of solving other intractable problems. Like, do you have a way to make a workable jetpack?
Well, let's work on that one too now. But the fun part of this for us is these are all statutory. We can do this by a simple change in law. So it's really an act of our own political imagination that is within reach.
Rob, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Rob Ritchie is executive director of the nonpartisan group Fair Vote and co-author of Every Vote Equal,